are listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore.
You're listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 LPFM. I am Steve Niebel, your host for today. David Gilmore is on hiatus right now. Today we are featuring award-winning poet, naturalist, and photographer, traveler, and occasional essayist, Bill Yeag. He's from Olympia. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it.
I really love the look of your book. It really is just a beautiful book. Of course, the words in it are nice too, but
I'm pretty happy with how it came out.
Yeah. Well, why don't we just start with reading something?
Actually, there's one that I start with. It's very short. That seems like a good launch point. Okay, so this launch point. The title is Five Lessons Learned Immediately on Getting Dumped from a Raft into a Wilderness River. One-on-one, there's no fighting a river. Adrenaline rivets the attention. Attend to the advice of guides. Of all physical entities, the most precious is air. Roll upright and go feet first into the unknown. So, going feet first into the unknown.
Those are good things to know. I've had that happen to me. Actually, the very first time I went river rafting, there were some people who had some rafts and invited us to go with them. And so we did. And the raft I was in got pinned up against a log. And so I had this water right in my face, and it was really an illuminating moment about the power of water.
The situation that this poem came out of was fairly similar. It was down on the Deschutes River, down near Bend, and I had gone down for a relative's wedding. But afterwards, a group of us were going to take this short raft trip at a place called Big Eddy. And same sort of thing. They gave us instructions, but I think our guide was like sort of green, and this maybe hadn't done a lot of this sort of stuff. So very soon after launching, we were headed directly for a large vertical rock on the right-hand side of the river. And exactly the same thing happened. It hit up against the rock. That side went up, the other side went down, the water poured in, it filled, it flipped it over. I had a cousin who was under the raft, but I was pretty much launched directly into the river. And those words of wisdom about going feet first and keeping upright came immediately to mind. And the stuff about how important breath and air is. It was an adrenaline rush, and adrenaline rushes create really strong memories.
I was much younger then. I can't even imagine what that would be like today. Right. You know, one of your poems that I really liked was The Heron, and that's just because there are so many blue herons in this part of the country. I've often seen them lined up, you know, like they were a salmon fisherman on the beach, you know. You'll see sometimes a lot of them.
Definitely an icon. We've got a lot of great blue herons down here in Olympia and Bud Inlet, and a rookery right at the base of the inlet. The heron, its beak a spear, its sixth vertebra an extended atlatl, kinking the neck spring to thrust and pierce. Quick, clean, true.
I can just see the bird there. I really enjoy that image. So why don't you just pick out another one?
It's called The Tree is Verb. And a little bit of a backstory. Nalini Netkarni is a really notable Evergreen faculty member and was responsible in large part for developing the discipline of canopy research, tree canopy research. Did a lot of work in the Olympics, did a lot of work in Central America, discovered, for instance, that trees here in our rainforests sometimes have essentially true roots that grow from the branches up into the moss that covers the branches, in addition to their roots in the soil, and lots of different discoveries. Anyway, I went to a talk, I think it was probably Native Plant Society, something like that. And at the time, she was engaged in outreach on the behalf of trees. She used whatever connection she could make between people and trees, skateboards being made out of wood. She developed what she called a treetop Barbie, which was a Barbie doll for young women, young girls, to sort of identify with being a scientist and studying trees. At any rate, one of the things that she mentioned during that talk was that people in general tend to think of trees as, even though they know they're animate, they think of them as inanimate, pretty much unmoving, not really full of life, I guess, if you will. Anyway, this poem was written as a response, thinking about what she had said. And one of the things she also mentioned, one of her tricks for getting past that, was to put paintbrushes on the ends of branches and then use paper to record the motions of those branches in a windstorm and to show how much a tree actually did move. Anyway, the poem, the tree is verb. It's got this epigraph, this writing at the beginning that says, "The true formula for thought is the cherry tree is all that it does." And that's Ernest Fenollosa. The tree is verb. Seed, swell, press and push, sprout, bud, curl, bloom, unfurl, quicken, ripen, and dispense. Remain. Blotch, ferment, rot, and mushroom. Germinate. Probe, grope, root, draw in, draw up, dole out, absorb, allot, assimilate, respire, reconstitute, and release. Senesce. Reach, brace, resist, avoid, deflect, splot, split, notch, rustle, shake, bend, and shimmy. Occupy. Cover. Mask. Obscure. Protect. Enclose and hide. Tolerate. Support. Feed. Shade. Harbor. And disguise. Stand. Sketch out. Stretch out. Fork. Reach. Branch. Divide. Incline. And sway. Reclaim, endure, and burn. Return. Leaf out, green up, synthesize, digest, night quiver, yellow, wilt and wither, abscess and collapse, to root and rise.
Wow, that's really a lot of words for trees. I have read that some trees become communities, that they communicate not only with their fellow trees, but with other elements of their environment, and that forests are very connected. That I know there was a movie about fungi that talks about how fungi are connected to this trees.
This is Paul Stamets' movie?
I think so, yeah.
I can't remember the name of it.
Isn't it Fabulous Fungi?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's a very cool movie. There's a lot of relatively new science, although some of it's not as new as it has been. It's been around for a while, showing communication mainly by way of roots, but I think also by way of airborne chemicals between trees, particularly trees in natural settings, maybe not so much trees in plantations, but a lot of that by mycorrhizal fungi, and how trees, if one of them is being attacked by insects, communication will go out for other trees in that area to make changes in their metabolism and whatnot to fend off those attacks. So yeah, very, very interesting and sort of reassuring.
One thing that was pointed out is that the trees on tree farms don't have this communication system going like the trees in old growth forests do.
Yeah, I think in general that's true.
Yeah. What do you have next for us?
So you mentioned I do some traveling, and we do some traveling. This is a little bit of a lighthearted poem that relates to travel a bit.
Okay.
And a lot of the travel we do is with friends. There's a group of us that go down to the Southwest or here and there. And we also tend to gather at solstice, at Thanksgiving, whatnot. I don't remember exactly where we were gathered that engendered this particular poem, but it's called Talk. And it's for Nigel, Ann, Jeanette, Greg, Gail, Larry, and Cedar. We were drinking tequila. There was a banjo in the corner of the room. Nigel said, well, we, by that he meant Ann and himself, got this room once, reserved it at a distance in a resort city. We got there, and all the rooms, they were done up in black velvet. We got out of there fast, forfeited our deposit. But then the next room, it was filled with millipedes. That turned Talk to rooms William Burroughs would have shunned. 6 layers of stained avocado wall paint and an armed night guard. And cockroaches, how at least one will always stand fast against the light. Then to a rainforest cabin where pack rats scurry half the night, across the cook stove, plastic-covered mattresses, your bare chest. To which Nigel mused, I was sitting once on the beach at this Florida Key, watching the sun go down, and this rat sidles over, leans up against me a minute or so anyway. He's watching the sunset too, I guess. And Anne, a legitimate biologist, I swear, she vouched for this.
Oh, I really like that. The rat leaning up against your friend and watching the sunset with him. That's pretty good. Millipedes. I don't really know very much about millipedes.
We have a few here in the Pacific Northwest. There's one.
I have seen them.
Millipede. I think it's black with yellow little legs and maybe yellow stripes between the various segments. There's millipedes and there's centipedes. And so the way you tell the difference between a millipede and a centipede, a millipede has 2 little legs on each side of each segment. And a centipede just has 1 leg on each side.
I haven't ever seen one in a motel room, actually.
I haven't either, but this, I have no reason to doubt Nigel.
Right.
I think he was speaking truth, although there was the tequila, so...
Why do millipedes like tequila? No, I just, you were talking about traveling, and one of your poems that I saw was The Rains of Darfur. That's a part of the world that's been getting a little bit of press these days, hasn't it?
That poem was no physical travel, just mental travel, trying to learn about a place and make sense of it. There was a group here in Olympia that was trying to raise attention and maybe 15 years ago. But a group of us with the Olympia Poetry Network participated in that, and as a process wrote poems to address it. And I wasn't familiar with Darfur, so I think the poem sort of explains my approach to trying to understand a little bit about their difficult situation. The Rains of Darfur. I begin with no TV, no map, no history, no trails, no kin, no blood, and no language, but these tiny 3-column-inch stories on page 6, factions, horsemen, rapes, and bones. So I begin with a 1911 encyclopedia. The climate is healthy, except after the rains. Chief trees are the acacias, whence gum is obtained, and baobab. The sycamore, and in the southwest, dense forests, cotton and tobacco, wheat, dura, and duchen. Sesame, cucumbers, watermelons, and onions. Camels and cattle are numerous, while the ostrich is bred by various Arab tribes, its feathers forming a valuable article of trade. The slave trade has ceased. This was 1911. Now, feathers, gum, and ivory constitute the chief exports. But ostrich plumes fetch little in 2007, and rains go slack. Vegetation stripped, village and waterhole perimeters eat holes where the desert grows, and hashib gum trees die. And the sand itself moves, a desert walking south at 5 kilometers a year. Herds waste and everyone covets rain. Where it still falls on the terraced flanks of Jebel Mara, herders take the farms. Farmers kill the starving herders who slay the desperate farmers in the worst years. The heat lightning crackles, and an AK-47 fully accessorized goes for $40 US, one for every man over 16. In Arabic, the dispossessed are called the Nazahin, and the genie demons on horseback, the Janjaweed. In Hijra, Silo, Kas, Tulis, and Ed al-Fursan, I imagine someone old chanting out melodic prayers for that vanished and unhealthy rain.
One of the reasons that I was interested in that is because I read an article recently about that's in an area called the Sahel, I believe. It's the countries that are on the southern edge of the Sahara Desert, right?
And I think to the east.
Right. All of those countries are becoming more arid all the time. And the economic result is that people become very combative with each other. There are a lot of people who are very vulnerable. It just becomes a very difficult situation just in the entire environment.
Absolutely. A friend who's a medical professional who's works over in that area and then comes back, he's dealing with a lot of the mental stress that war and that sort of thing creates for people, and trying to come up with ways to counter that, like PTSD. And in fact, he's back here studying some of the alternative methods for dealing with PTSD that are coming to the fore, particularly use of various what would otherwise be considered psychedelics.
So why don't you just pick out something that you'd like?
Okay, well, one of the places that we went to a few years back is Haida Gwaii, which used to be called the Queen Charlotte's, but it's the homeland of the Haida folks, and it's been formally renamed Haida Gwaii. And if old cultures, native cultures, wildlife, whales, a little bit of rain appeals to you. It's a wonderful place to visit if you can. The poem is called The Hidden, from the now abandoned villages of Haida Gwaii. Begin with our present tenuous foothold by the sea. Walk inland, and the green moss of forest will swallow and hide you. Paddle seaward, and the sky will swallow you in cloud and the village in alder smoke. The sea drags our long lines down, our halibut hooks. We have seen the strait swallow whales whole. Walk backwards, and time will swallow you whole. Tuck you out of sight behind the house skin, beneath the earth skin, turn you blue beneath the tricks played by light on water, by water doing its dance of waves crossing waves, by the flickering of candlefish. Nearby you hear a heart you cannot see. Six kin ravens gossip over food behind a damp sheet of mist, their voices like trip hammers striking at small wooden boxes. Specific pollens are falling on water. Years hence, they'll be keyed from layered sea muck and bog varves, cloudberry and Calder's lovage. Stories await decoding. All these sleights of hand smearing winter tallow and the char of shelf fungus on our faces to face the sea with all its death, all death's rifts and rifts. Survive this, and by next turning, you'll hail midsummer's fair weather woman with sweetmeats of blue mussel roasting open by the house fire. Even ghosts linger when they catch, as they must, the scent of this rich and wistful world.
Lovely. How long were you out there?
It was, I think, 10 days. The particular folks we were traveling with had a small boat. I think it had been a research boat, and it was retrofitted to carry kayaks. So we traveled from Queen Charlotte City, which is near the center of Haida Gwaii, it's actually on the south end of the Northern Island, and went south from there all the way to the extreme southern tip of the archipelago. Humpback whales, the old villages, the remains of lodge poles and totem poles. It was a magical.
Moving right along.
Okay. There's a woman by the name of Marcy Summers, who is the principal of a nonprofit called ALTO. Essentially, it's a cross-island nonprofit interested in art and preserving wild species and culture and a lot of different things. And Marcy is an amazing, wonderful woman. So she promotes that and convinces through her knowledge and magnetic personality folks to go to this part of Sulawesi and engage in her nonprofit. The poem, Bat Island, Taima, Sulawesi, Indonesia, for Marcy Summers. It should have been the dry season, but it had rained all afternoon before clearing. The flying foxes were late, the sky's fire out, the dusk thickening. When finally they appeared, determined darknesses streaming northwest against an obscure sky, she shouted and danced in the sand, arms stretched and tilting like wings. A stream of minutes and minutes and minutes. 3,000, she thought, heading for the mainland. Last year there'd been 10,000. Then the bushmeat hunters sailed in from Manado. They stayed days, netted thousands that died in kin clusters squalling. Then packed as treats, they were shipped to the Christian north for the feasts of Christmas. What few bats remained did not remain. They emptied out the island, left its miniature forest to the insects, its beach to the nautilus shells and small conches, its waters to the villagers fishing offshore, their outrigger canoes painted yellow, orange, and blue. The foxes flew off, left dusk and dawn empty for months, empty but for the waves and cicadas. But now they were back, diminished, yes, but a village of 3,000 pollen and nectar-feeding bats streaming for the mainland's fruiting forest, and Marcy was dancing in the sand.
You mentioned that the bats were killed because they were for the Christian North for the feasts of Christmas. That is just such a totally foreign concept to me. I don't know very much about fruit bats. Prior to hearing your poem and Sandra Noel's poem, I had never thought of bats as being food at all.
Right. There's lots of things, yeah, that we don't think of as food, bushmeat, and that could be even involved in the source of the pandemic. The market in Hunan, it's not uncommon in a lot of cultures.
Anyway, I thought that was interesting, but I thought that this winter in the interior was interesting too.
Sure. So this friend, Larry Goldstein, was somebody, still a friend, and we're going to be at Thanksgiving together. Larry and I used to run at noontime from at St. Martin's College, which is where the Department of Ecology's headquarters was, where we both worked. And so we would talk as we ran or as we got ready to run. And this poem comes from what he related of his time in Alaska. Winter in the interior, based on the experiences of Larry Goldstein. Salmon were walking up the creek bed on their bellies when the wind blew the sun out. Winter blew plovers south, frogs underground, and covered the mice in dust, snow dry and squeaking underfoot. Raven, the winter bird, white within black, shrinks far distances down to a single audible wing beat. All winter I awoke in the dark cabin, turning once with arms outstretched before the fire. Outside, in the long night, feathers were tracing arcs in the repetitious snow. I never told you this, but that was the best year of my life.
I totally get that poem. We're ready for another poem.
Oh, dear. One that you mentioned that you liked, and I do too. This poem is called Merlin's Delaguamish Flats Two Hunts. And it has an epigraph as well, which is, "And falcons fly like this, one hand held high, claps with a rapid, stiff, staccato wing beat." And that was from Bud Anderson. Bud Anderson, for a number of years, taught classes on raptors, hawks, in Western Washington. He lived up in Bow, and he also had a wildlife business where he banded a number of peregrine falcons and tracked them to South America, and was involved, I think, in rehab of hawks as well. Anyway. Merlin's Delaguamish Flats, Two Hunts. One, high in the spring bare cottonwood, a merlin watches intently, bobs her head, fixing the distance to her prey, then lifts her wings and drops away. She is dark streaked, flies flat and fast into the shadows of dairy barns, machinery sheds. Pigeons explode into spring light, their wings clacking. A racket of blackbirds way up in black poplars stops into silence. She misses, circles away over flooded pasture lands, beating her wings like applause. 2. Just west of here, a dike divides the pastures from the sound, from the tide flats. The tide is high. The sun is low. A loose cloud, no, a galaxy of Dunlin wheels eclipses bird by bird the spackled sun, the sun stuttering on water. Near birds stream north, far birds south, in a slow, whirling, spiral flight. Merlin, high shadow. Tightening in vertical tumult, the flock draws in and up to a cumulus cloud of synchronous flashing. We hear their thousand wings turn at once from light to black, their one mind conjured by and conjuring the high, lone hand. She perceives, discerns, clenches, stoops. The flock boils and flattens out against the flood tide. Splits in two, hisses like a sudden rain.
Wow, you spent a lot of time watching those birds, didn't you? that's pretty amazing, all the detail you have of the birds flying and hunting. And you know, I was wondering about the blackbirds you mentioned. It seems like I don't very often see a flock of blackbirds. I see crows in big groups. I see starlings in big groups. I think of red-winged blackbirds. Are there blackbirds that, besides red-winged blackbirds that live in this part of the country?
There are. One of the most common is Brewer's blackbirds, and I think that's what these were, barnyards and sometimes in large numbers. And I think that's what was going on here.
Huh.
There's jaegers, which are a seabird and a hunting seabird.
Well, I really liked your descriptions. That was, let's go on to another poem.
I'd like to pay homage in readings, and I didn't really bring along a poem by somebody else to read, but this one sort of gets at it. Robert Sund is known locally as the poet laureate of Ish River Country, and Robert passed some time ago, but he was one of those original poets associated with Empty Bowl, a really renowned and excellent poet, an artist. He was associated with, you're probably familiar with the place called Fishtown, which was at the mouth of the Skagit back in the 70s.
No, I'm not, but.
Okay, well, there were a number of artists and writers and free spirits, as I understand it, who lived in fishing shacks on stilts at the mouth of the Skagit. This poem was written in memoriam for Robert Sund. Although I never met him, I really appreciate his poetry. For Robert Sund in memoriam, 1. Shack walls must leak a little storm, breathe. Inside, candles flick and waver. Wind on snares all night, so cliffs and shore cobble make a shy beach and silver boxcar sound. 2. Where do we go? Characters, shack dwellers, dancers. After the band folds and all the books are shelved. 3. Shaking off the night rain, the living are joined by death. The dead lie elbow to elbow and low like the sea. 4. A skiff, your poems remain. If you ever have a chance, come across a collection called Bunchgrass. These are poems that Sund wrote soon after leaving college at the UW.
Oh, great. Why don't you pick out a poem to end with?
Okay, well, this is a bit of a strange one, but somehow jumps out. This one from a trip also involving kayaks on the from the Sea of Cortez, so the body of water that's between Mexico and Baja California, called Baja Noir. We beach our kayaks on the sandstone Punta Gata, its articulated cliffs burnt to the ferrous of coals or crab shells. Sleek vultures perch atop huge white whale vertebrae, sperm remains, a backbone. Among boulders, isopods work the shadows, skitter like loose fingers till the full moon flattened as fire rises from the sea, and the selfsame sea rolls back from freshly unmarked sands. At dusk, crepuscular coyotes trot the beach. Long-legged green crabs scramble from their womb burrows to sketch the plural excursions beneath the broadcast moonstruck seabirds who have altered all the protocols of night to seize lithe moonlit minnows whole. Behold, beach cuttlefish and hefty squid ink the wave lap. Scorpions fluoresce in the stranded wrack, a hidden, delicate lethality. Till, at dawn, an inland dented pickup creeps to market so full of oranges its bed thuds, scrapes, and shoots sparks. The west setting moon has, all up and down this harsh and fecund coast, settled into empty cactus arms.
Well, thank you for being with us here today at Sound Poetry. Bill, where can we get your books?
Okay, well, you certainly can get them from Empty Bowl Press, going online and purchasing them there. They also would be available on order from any bookstore, and I would hope that you would choose an independent bookstore to make your purchase.
Bill's book is called Waymaking by Moonlight. This one, you have several books that you have out, right?
Yeah, this is the third full collection, and then there are some what are called chapbooks, shorter.
Like I say, this is a lovely book. It's interesting the way that the photography is laid out in places in it, and of course you've been listening to his poetry from this book. And once again, thank you for being here. You've been listening to Sound Poetry. I'm your host, Steve Niebel, sitting in for David Gilmore, who is in hiatus right now. And thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you, Steve.